Okay. Our session tonight will be the last session on the topic of Zionism after a year devoted to this subject matter. And the issue at hand is the membership of Israel in the United Nations. It's an important topic and one that we have to address because if you recall, almost a year ago, the goal of Zionism, at least as defined by the Basel program of Theodor Herzl, was to secure in public law a national homeland for the Jewish people. Well, public law means that some international body shall say this is kosher. And in 1897, certainly no such international body existed. There were the colonial powers. But in 1923, it was the League of Nations that issued the mandate. And in 1947, it was the United Nations that voted on partition of Palestine, including for a Jewish state. And in 1949, it shall be the United Nations that votes on whether or not the state of Israel, the newly formed state of Israel, shall be admitted to membership in the General Assembly. Well, is this an important vote in the grand scheme of things or not? I mean, Israel already existed. So is it as earth-shattering as November 29th, 1947? So if you asked Abba Ibn, the great Abba Ibn, the foreign minister of Israel, the great ambassador of Israel, he would have said, and he did say in his autobiography, that the vote taken in May of 1949 was actually more important than the vote taken in November of 47. Because he said in November of 47, it was a question of shall Jewish statehood be denied or allowed? Whereas in May of 49, it was an existing Jewish state being rejected or welcomed. And to be denied is one thing, but to be rejected is quite another. So in his view, the 49 vote was of utmost importance. What happened was Israel applied for membership in the United Nations in late 1948, and its petition was not accepted at first. Instead, the United Nations passed several resolutions that were germane to the situation in the former British Mandate, including Resolution 194 on December 11, 1948, which we'll get to at some length. But Israel's membership was deferred. Well, in the spring of 1949, it could be deferred no longer. The question had to be addressed. And so there was an ad hoc political committee of all the member nations to discuss the matter before making a decision one way or the other, which would then kick it down to the General Assembly for a secondary vote. Okay, so the ad hoc political committee basically came to the conclusion that it would be logical for the United Nations, which created the State of Israel, to also admit that State of Israel into membership in its organization. The committee spent 10 meetings studying every aspect of the matter. Well, what was so controversial about Israel's admission into the UN? The question is whether Israel was a peace-loving country and whether it would abide by the UN Charter and it would play well with others, and whether it would abide by the pre-existing resolutions that were relevant to its fate, notably the Partition Plan, Resolution 181 of 1947, and Resolution 194 of December of 1948, which issued several important rulings, including the right of return for Palestinian Arab refugees and the internationalization of Jerusalem, among many other important points. So what would be the attitude of the government of Israel, a government led by David Ben-Gurion, with his foreign minister Moshe Sharet, or Moshe Shertok, what would their attitude be towards the implementation of partition? Well, we know that Ben-Gurion didn't like the partition borders, and the State of Israel, according to the armistice agreements, was much larger than the partition borders. So that's already a problem with the UN. What about the internationalization of Jerusalem? Well, it didn't happen. And who controlled West Jerusalem? Israel. What about the Arab refugees? Well, they were not being welcomed back, and in fact, any of those who attempted to return under cover of darkness or sneaking through the border were summarily arrested. So on various fronts, the State of Israel's policy, in fact, and as stated in document, was not what the United Nations wanted to hear. And would that be enough of a problem to cause enough member nations to vote against Israel's admission into the organization? that Israel needed 2/3 majority of the voting members to get in. So all it took was a third of the voting members to be annoyed with Israel's behavior to say no. Well, there was a vote taken. And the proposal was to defer a vote on Israel's membership to another cycle, to the fourth General Assembly meeting in September of 49. This was a proposal put forth by Lebanon, which obviously as an Arab state opposed Israel's existence, and the vote was rejected, 25 to 19 to 12 abstentions. So because it didn't have a 2/3 majority, the deferral of Israel's membership vote for another lengthy period of time was rejected. Instead, the United States and Paraguay and Panama and Australia and Canada and Haiti put forth a different vote saying, let's have the ad hoc committee vote on this now for the General Assembly to vote on it immediately thereafter. And that passed by a vote of 33 to 11 with 12 abstentions. So with the ad hoc committee's political work done, it will eventually go to the General Assembly for a final vote as to Israel's admission. So like we did with the partition vote, I want to go through what the various member nations of the United Nations said and thought about the candidacy of Israel. Okay, so first we go with the rapporteur from the ad hoc committee, who was from Ecuador. And this was Mr. Lafronte. And he said that if admitted, Israel would take its place in the General Assembly by alphabetical order in between Iraq and Lebanon. And he said, well, that might sound like a very ominous thing. No, actually, it's a good thing, because the ambassadors will have a collegial attitude, and Israel will learn to develop decent relations with even their bitterest foes of Iraq and Lebanon. Did it work out that way? Not exactly. Historically, even though Israel is near Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, the I and the L countries and the K countries like Kuwait. So yes, alphabetically, it's near some of its bitterest rivals, but no favorable relations ever developed from sitting next to one another. Okay. Let's go to Poland. Poland had a lot to say on the issue of Israel's admission. And if I had to ask you right now, take a guess, do you think Poland voted yes or Poland voted no? I wonder what you guys would say, the 44 of you listening right now. But I'll give away the answer. Poland voted in favor of Israel's admission, but with not a caveat, but with a warning in the words of the ambassador. And let's take a look at that. So the Polish ambassador said that it's obvious that Israel cannot be expected in the here and now to adhere to every last jot and tittle of the various resolutions that have been passed that are relevant to it. Meaning, we're going to cut you some slack. We know you can't admit all the Arab refugees in Jerusalem. You don't want to have internationalized. And there's a lot of things that the UN wants from you that you're not really ready to do, or maybe ever ready to do. But for the time being, we're going to cut you some slack. We'll give you some leeway, some wiggle room. Okay? The Polish ambassador then said, we are a Catholic country. Now, bear in mind, it's a communist country, so in theory it's atheist, but it's predominantly Polish Catholic, okay? And they said, we're satisfied with President Chaim Weizmann's assurances that the Catholic holy places and the various holy places of other religions will be respected and there will be free access. So we were worried about that, but now we're not so worried. We have your assurance and we believe it. We are hopeful for a resolution of Jewish-Arab difficulties in the spirit of opposing imperialistic designs in the Middle East. In other words, who's the real enemy? The Western imperialists, the great mighty empires, the Americans, the British, especially the British. So the Jews and the Arabs, yeah, you don't like each other, you don't get along, but your real enemy, everyone's real enemy, are the Western imperialists. Okay, then he mentions that Poland and the Jews have a 1,000-year history together. Well, they sure do. We actively supported their independence, which was true in 1947. And we know they suffered under the reactionary pre-war Polish regime, which is a nice way of saying blame the right-wing fascists, but as for us left-wing communists, we're wonderful. And that, yes, Jews suffered in 1930s Poland, but only because the wrong side of the political aisle was in control. The Jews contributed much to progressive thought, a.k.a. communism. So here you see the Polish are building up to a crescendo how the Jews are so wonderful because the Jews are all communists. All right, then, quote, The period of sentimental interest in the fate of Israel has come to an end. An era of cooperation based upon mutual interest is beginning. The Jewish people advancing along peaceful and progressive lines could rely upon the assistance of Poland and the Soviet republics and the people's democracies of Europe. Israel would doubtless remember that those countries had been its true friends in the troubled times of its emergence. So what's he saying here? He's saying, the era of sentiment is over. We were good to you, the Jews, for a little while. But don't count on it anymore unless you toe the party line and join the Soviet bloc. If you join the Soviet bloc, we'll be your best friends. If you don't, well, we're going to stab you in the back, basically. But for the time being, we'll vote for you, because we think you may join the Soviet bloc. Okay, then he continues, along the lines of the East is wonderful and the West is all terrible. Quote, it was not long since the British Foreign Office had tried and failed to prevent the creation of Israel. Now, on that, he's right. The British actively worked against the interests of Zionism throughout 1947 and early 1948 and did try to prevent the emergence of a Jewish state, of a viable Jewish state. The United States government's change of policy with regard to Israel has occurred for reasons of political expediency, this divorce from any sense of justice or faith in Israel's future. In other words, it's not that America loves the Jews, but rather, democratic politicians love the Jewish vote. That's what the Polish representative is saying. He's saying, don't think America loves the Jews. They don't. They just want your votes. Okay? And the rest is more communist gibberish about how the working class is the be-all and end-all, and the Zionist working classes will be in solidarity with the Eastern European working classes. Okay, so the Poles do whatever it is that the Poles do. Next one is El Salvador. El Salvador. So, El Salvador, if you recall, had voted against partition. And they, on this occasion, would also vote against Israel's admission to the United Nations. Their government had issued formal instructions to vote in favor of Israel's admission, but the ambassador, acting independently, voted against his government's wishes. Why? Well, The record, the protocol says his real complaints were Israel's non-compliance with the partition borders and with the issue of the internationalization of Jerusalem, and especially with the issue of Palestinian refugees, and that he couldn't in good conscience vote for Israel's admission to the United Nations when it was in flagrant disregard of all these obligations that were outstanding for it to accomplish. Okay, fine. Was the guy an anti-Semite? I don't know. I wasn't there. But clearly, it bothered him that Israel wasn't playing by what he thought the rules were. Let's now go to Iraq. As you can imagine, Iraq, being a virulently anti-Zionist Arab country, is going to vote no. But what does it have to say for itself while voting no? So the Iraqi ambassador was actually a savvy guy. And he said, well, listen, everybody, I know some of you want to vote for Israel's admission, and we all know that there are these issues of Jerusalem and refugees and borders that we have to resolve. But you guys who are trusting the Israelis, why are you trusting them? After all, the Israeli ambassador's assurances about compliance have been vague and evasive, and their execution is by no means guaranteed. Quote, should the General Assembly content itself with mere promises and ignore its own previous decisions? This is actually very interesting because going forward over the next 70 years, Israel would very often find itself in non-compliance with United Nations Security Council or General Assembly resolutions. And the question is whether the United Nations as an institution would stick to its guns and pummel Israel or would essentially let things slide. And the Iraqis are saying, well, don't set a precedent of letting things slide. Okay. Moreover, the Iraqis focus on the assassination of Count Folke Bernadotte, who had been the UN mediator in Palestine throughout 1948 until his assassination by the Lehi on September 17th, 48. And he said that, the Jews are doing nothing to punish the perpetrators, so this should be counted as a strike against them. Moreover, and this is his most important point, and it's a point which is still relevant to this day, Arayom Hazeh, he said, was the assembly satisfied that the applicant state had definite boundaries within which it exercised its jurisdiction? In other words, the state of Israel didn't announce its boundaries in the Declaration of Independence, and it never announced its boundaries really ever. It just had armistice agreements with neighboring Arab states, which by all parties' acknowledgement was not an international frontier. So where are the real borders of the state of Israel? The Iraqi ambassador wants to know. And nobody's really giving him a straight answer. Okay? So in the end, he says that to accept Israel into the UN would be a grievous breach of international law and would be another nail in the coffin of the United Nations. Now, Jews tend to think, you know, for the last bunch of decades, that all the anti-Israel resolutions show that the United Nations is a farce and that it's another nail in the coffin of the UN's legitimacy. Well, the Arabs thought the very same thing, except flip it around. In their view, Israel was a rogue state in 1948, and Israel's admission was a nail in the coffin to the legitimacy of the UN. Okay, what about Egypt? So Egypt, being the largest, most populous, and most relevant of the Arab states, what do they have to say on the issue of Israel's admission? Clearly, they're going to vote no. But what points do they want to make? And their ambassador pulled a real fast one. So he says, well, the three main issues are, of course, holy places / Jerusalem. Secondly, the issue of Arab refugees. And thirdly, the issue of Bernadotte's assassination. And that the answers by the Israeli representatives have been unsatisfactory on all three fronts. But, and not only that, but that the assassins of Bernadotte were given decorations, honorific commendations by the Israeli government. Now, is that really true? I don't know. As far as I can tell, that's not true. Although, as I mentioned, Yoshua Cohen, who was the assassin, later became Ben-Gurion's bodyguard at Sde Boker in the Negev. But whether he was given an accommodation by the government, I really don't know. Okay. So the Egyptian ambassador, in a manner of gamesmanship, said, hey, fine, if you guys want to vote for Israel's admission, then let the resolution voting for Israel's admission have the following preamble. And I'm going to read to you the preamble that the Egyptian wanted to include in the resolution. Okay, it says like this. Considering that the applicant has invaded Palestine, driven its people from their homes, deprived them from their possessions, blocked their return, and even refused to pay compensation, considering that the applicant has desecrated the holy places and still endangers the peace in the Middle East, considering the assassination of the United Nations mediator by people belonging to the applicant who are not prosecuted for their crime, considering that the applicant has in proceeding in other ways defied and undermined the United Nations, considering that the same time the pervading intrigues of the applicant, the daily bringing into force Article 4 of the United Nations Charter, discharge their obligations as stipulated in the article, considering that in this respect the consequent helplessness of the United Nations, comma, the General Assembly resolves to admit the country into admission. Okay, so this was the Egyptians' way of saying the Jews are guilty of a whole lot, host of offenses, but you guys nonetheless want them in. Okay, so Phil's asking, could the Polish government actually want Israel so the Jewish people would not return to Poland to reclaim Jewish property? Okay, that's an interesting suggestion. And the answer to that may be, in part, yes, that there was a desire on the part of the Poles not to have a significant Jewish population in the post-war era. And it is true that Jews were languishing in DP camps in Central Europe. And the opportunity for them to go to Israel and to have a viable Israel, as opposed to remaining in Poland, is a real consideration for the Polish government. That is correct. Then Moshe asks me, aren't the holy places in the hands of Jordan? Well, it depends which holy places. If you're talking about Nazareth and the Christian holy places, that's in the hands of Israel. If you're talking about Mount Zion and the so-called Kever David, the Dormition Abbey, the Room of the Last Supper, that's in the hands of Israel. If you're talking about the Old City, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Temple Mount, the Kotel, the Alaska Mosque, Beit Lechem, Church of the Nativity, that's all in the hands of the Jordanians. So some things are in Israeli hands and some things are in Jordanian hands. But especially from Christian point of view, there's an interest in Nazareth. Okay. So this is the Egyptian Mishigas. Let's now go to the United States. All right. The United States had one very basic point, and that was that the armistice agreements, which were being signed at that time between Israel and its neighboring Arab countries, were leading the way to peace. And if not outright peace, then at least to resolving the outstanding issues. And that Israel should not be held with its feet to the fire by the United Nations over these various outstanding issues because they will be resolved in bilateral negotiations. That was the American point of view. Okay, it was to Israel's advantage that the Americans would say that because... Okay. So the United States voted in favor of Israel's admission and said Israel will become a valuable member of the United Nations and it should be admitted. Was there ever any hesitation by the Americans on this front? The answer is probably not, but the Truman administration did express to Israel its dissatisfaction with Israel's recalcitrance and obstinance on certain issues pertaining to the refugees and to the border. But they didn't take it out against Israel in the UN vote. Very important. What about Syria? So Syria are a bunch of Jew-hating anti-Zionists, and they deny that Israel is a peace-loving state, and so they vote no. What about Lebanon? Lebanon has by far the most interesting line of the whole discussion. Without a doubt, the Lebanese played a constructive role here, even though they're Israel's enemy and counterpart in war and would vote against Israel's admission, the Lebanese did say something relevant. And what is that? They said that Zionism is about to unleash radical Islamic fundamentalism and radical Palestinian nationalism. Boy, is that true. If truer words were ever spoken, I don't know. But the Lebanese understood that the refugee problem is not something that they're holding over Israel's head as a demographic bomb to destroy Israel. They're saying in all earnestness that there are now hundreds of thousands of Arabs who are beyond their former borders and are going to get really disgruntled because life stinks for them. And what's going to emerge? Radical nationalism and radical Islam. Well, the Lebanese were 100% right, and it destroyed their country. And they're still suffering to this very day for that reality. Okay, but the Lebanese had one more important point to make. And that is, they said, if the Western world, the Christian world, failed to take advantage of the opportunity offered by the consent of the Muslims to live in peace, equality, and freedom with Christians and Jews in Jerusalem under an international regime, history would record another tragedy that could have been avoided. Meaning, the Lebanese are claiming that the Muslims of Jerusalem, the Muslim world, is okay with Jerusalem going internationalized with equal rights for Muslims, Christians, and Jews. And that if we don't take us up on it, it's a tragedy. Meaning if you allow a Jewish West Jerusalem and a Jordanian East Jerusalem, rather than a united city with everybody in Kumbaya together, then we've lost a tremendous opportunity. Because never before have the Muslims consented to this. Well, let me ask you an interesting question. Did the Muslims really consent to this? No, not at all. Every Arab Muslim country voted against Resolution 181, and every Arab Muslim country voted against Resolution 194. But now that those resolutions have passed and they can be used as a cudgel against the Jews, it's convenient to say we love these resolutions, and in those resolutions the world said Jerusalem shall be an internationalized city where we're all singing Kumbaya. So basically, they flip it on its head. Now, what was the hesitation on the part of Israel and the Jordanians to move towards internationalization? Well, the answer is everybody wants to keep what they have in their possession. Nobody ever wants to give up. So it was unreasonable all along to expect anybody to give up territory to an international regime. But the United Nations has this idea in their head that they won't give it up. Okay. What about Yemen? So Yemen, the Yemeni ambassador, tells the whole history. He says, listen, in the olden days, you know, in the year Gimel, in 1917, Jews were 7% of Palestine. The Jewish Arabs were 7% of the Palestinian population. And then Western imperialists got in the way and allowed all these European Jews to show up, and they changed the demographic balance, and they ruined the country. So we should restore the status quo ante, kick out the Jews, and go back to the way it was in 1917. All right, that's the Yemeni ambassador with his backward mishigas. What about Guatemala? So if you recall, when we discussed 1947, wait, it was a question from iPad. Who was in power in Lebanon at the time, and what were their religious leanings? So the answer is, ever since 1932, there was a constitutional arrangement whereby the presidency and the prime ministership of Lebanon are shared. One is a Christian and one is a Muslim. And so it's a mixed bag. It's a power-sharing arrangement where the Christians had an outsized share of power given their percentage of the population. Okay. So the Guatemala was represented by Ambassador Granados. And Granados was a big, big Zionist. If you recall, he was the leading figure of among UNSCOP in favor of a Jewish state. And he says, we vote in favor of Israel's admission without hesitation. It's a wonderful country. I look forward to being the ambassador there. And he was sent off to become the ambassador to Israel. Okay. France. So France was a little bit duplicitous here, as is the style of France to be duplicitous. Okay. So the French ambassador acknowledged that under the circumstances in the post-Holocaust era, there was no way that France could vote against the admission of a Jewish state into the General Assembly. It just wasn't going to be possible for France to do that. Okay. It would be too nasty, seen as too anti-Semitic. Okay. But it favored an international regime in Jerusalem. It questioned how large Jerusalem would be for this purpose, meaning what is international Jerusalem? It was willing to concede that a minimalist approach would be just the old city. Just the old city of Jerusalem would be internationalized. But it acknowledged that other people wanted a larger territorial swath that would be internationalized, and it would be up to the UN to figure out which one is more appropriate. But then, and this is an important quote, pay attention. It tells you a little bit about where France's true interests were. Quote, Israel was offered the opportunity to exercise its responsibilities. Its adventure would not be complete unless, after suffering pain and violence, it demonstrated that it could also exercise charity. No human accomplishment was lasting unless it was built on love. No nation was better equipped to show its generosity and sense of justice than the very people which had suffered so long from injustice and hatred. In other words, turn the other cheek. So this is a very Christian notion that the French are trying to impose upon the Jews, meaning we know you Jews have been a beleaguered people for 2,000 years and everybody spits on you and kills you, but now that you have a little bit of power, be nice to your enemy. So why are the French saying this? The answer is simple. The French have interests throughout the Middle East and the Muslim world. The French were uncertain of themselves in 1947 whether they would vote for partition, and at the last second, it was almost an attempt to vote no, or at least to abstain. It was only with political chicanery and machinations that the Zionists were able to get France to vote yes. So having voted yes in 47, they were going to vote yes in 49, but they want to throw a little crumb, a little sucker to the Arabs. So they tell Israel in front of everybody, Israel, play nice, be nice, and have charity and love. The Saudis. The Saudis were the nastiest of them all. They said it would be unwise to admit an artificially created state with a record of systematic aggression and flagrant violation of the basic principles of the charter. The Zionists have driven from their homes 900,000 Arabs and has committed atrocities not unlike those perpetrated by the Nazis. Whoa! So the Zionist Nazis, that's what the Saudis have to say here. Then they say we have no choice but to vote against the admission of the so-called State of Israel. They don't even want to say State of Israel. They want to say Zionist entity or State of the Jews or Zionist hoodlums or gangs. It's only with great hesitation that they even mention the so-called State of Israel. Okay. The next one is Uruguay. So Uruguay was represented by Ambassador Fabregat, and Uruguay together with Guatemala were the two leading Zionist countries in the Western world, and they were the leaders of an UNSCOP to call for partition. So Fabregat said, yes, there are issues that have to be resolved in the Middle East, but first and foremost, we're going to resolve the problem of Jewish national homelessness. He sounds like a real Zionist here. The real problem is Jewish homelessness, and that means Israel and the admission of Israel to the United Nations. Then and only later will we worry about other matters of political and diplomatic concern. So he says, and I'll quote him, first, the solution to the territorial problem of the Jews. Secondly, the establishment of independent Palestine. Third, an international regime for the holy places in the old city. And fourth, an end to elimination of all discrimination. So it's acknowledging we want to end discrimination, we want to be good to the Arabs, and so on and so forth. But number one, Jewish territorial problem, the homelessness of the Jew. That's a real good Christian Zionist. Okay. What about Cuba? So if you recall, in 47, Cuba voted against partition. It was the only Western country to do so. And why it did, we examined. Was it because the ambassador was an anti-Semite? Or was it because of an economic issue? Or was it to give a shtach to the United States? There's a variety of theories as to why they voted against partition. But Cuba ended up voting in favor of Israel's admission to the UN. Why? What changed? So the answer is that they were given assurances about social justice for the Arab citizens of Israel and for the protection of holy places that are of interest to the Catholics. So a letter was sent by Abba Ibn to the Cuban ambassador, identifying whatever issues might have been and giving satisfactory answers. So Cuba voted its conscience and voted in favor of partition. What was the bottom line here? The bottom line was a vote of 37 in favor, 12 against, and 9 abstentions. So it had the two-thirds majority. It had the two-thirds majority. Well, with this in mind, Moshe Sharet was invited to the rostrum as a newly admitted member nation of the UN to give a little speech. And he gave a speech which was well received, in which he said what the policy of Israel will be as formulated by the Prime Minister and government of Israel. And it had five basic principles, five principles of Israel's participation in an international body. Number one, loyalty to the fundamental principles of the United Nations Charter and friendship with all peace-loving states, especially the United States of America and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Now, what does that tell you? I want someone to unmute themselves and tell me what is Sheretok, in the name of Ben-Gurion, trying to get across when he mentions specifically the U.S. and the USSR?
Not a lot of alignment.
Okay, good. So there is the non-aligned bloc that exists, which is not part of the Western bloc and not part of the Soviet bloc, although historically the non-aligned bloc was closer to the Soviets than they were to the Americans. And what Ben-Gurion is hoping for is that neither side will try to destroy us. Okay, Moshe asks, how did the British vote? The British abstained. As they did in 47, they abstained in 49. So what Ben-Gurion wants is American friendship and Soviet non-aggression, basically. He knows that in the long run, it's going to be impossible to retain Soviet friendship for Israel, but at least let the Soviet bloc as a whole not be our worst and bitterest enemies. I mean, yes, there were people in the Israeli government that time, in the Mapam, who believed that the Soviet Union was the be-all and end-all and wanted to be in the Soviet camp. Ben-Gurion was never that way. He understood the evils of Leninism and Stalinist communism. But, you know, he wants to play it safe. He doesn't want to have enemies in the Cold War. Point number two, efforts to achieve an Arab-Jewish alliance based upon economic, social, cultural, and political cooperation with neighboring countries. This alliance must be within the framework of the United Nations and cannot be directed against any of the members. So this is a lot of highfalutin language, which doesn't really mean all that much. What it's saying is, yes, in an ideal world, we'd like to be a part of the Middle East, where we can have diplomatic relations and economic, you know, commerce that crosses frontiers. We don't want Israel to be a garrison state where you can't cross any borders. So we're hoping for the best. Okay. Three, support for all measures which strengthen peace, guarantee the rights of men and equality of nations, and enhance the authority and effectiveness of the United Nations. So this is Israel's way of saying that, yeah, we really are peace-loving. We don't want to have a second round of fighting. We're satisfied with our territorial arrangement that here and now, and we would like this to be, you know, going forward, the way we roll. But you know, we need the United Nations to be strong, and to be strong not against us, but in favor of real peace. Four, the right of all Jews who wish to resettle in their historic homeland to leave the countries of their present abode. This is important because it's not true at the moment that Jews from all countries could leave their present abode. Jews are being locked into certain Arab countries, which are not yet letting them out, and in Soviet bloc countries, where they're not yet letting them out. So Zionism means Aliyah, okay, the free flow of Jewish immigration to Eretz Yisrael, and large percentages of the world Jewry are still closed off to the Jewish state. Now, the Arab countries, those would mostly open up in 1950 and 51, 52, especially the Iraqi Jews, some of the Moroccan Jews, the Egyptian Jews, Jews from Aden and from Yemen. Okay, there'll be a massive aliyah from the Islamic countries in the year or two to follow, and they'll all be sent to the Ma'abarot. All right, but in May of 49, that wasn't yet known. Then five, the effective preservation of the complete independence and sovereignty of Israel. So this is an important point, because it was not a foregone conclusion that the United Nations would respect the complete independent sovereignty of Israel. I mean, there's all sorts of talk about changing the borders of the status of Jerusalem. Israel is being treated as though it is still a work in progress, like silly putty in the hands of the international bosses to figure out what it's going to look like. And what Shertok is saying in the name of Ben-Gurion, in the name of the government, is we are a real country. We're not a banana republic. We're not playing games here. And we mean business. Leave us alone. Don't try to interfere with our sovereignty. Okay. So let me just read to you who voted in what way. Approval. Argentina, Australia, Bolivia, Belarus, Canada, Chile, China, Colombia, Costa Rica, Cuba, Czechoslovakia, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, France, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Iceland, Liberia, Luxembourg, Mexico, New Zealand, the Netherlands, Nicaragua, Norway, Panama, Paraguay, Peru, Philippines, Poland, South Africa, Ukraine, Russia, United States, Uruguay, Venezuela, Yugoslavia. Who voted no? Let's see. Afghanistan, to be expected. Burma, sort of also to be expected. Egypt, Ethiopia, India, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Yemen. Who abstained? Some of these are curiosities. Belgium, Brazil, Denmark, El Salvador, Greece, Siam, Sweden, Turkey, and the UK. So what were some of the changes between 47 and 49? Okay. Mush is asking, didn't Mexico abstain in 47? What changed? Correct, that there were some changes. Mexico abstained in 47 because of its Arab population, because of a rift with the United States. There were a variety of reasons for Mexico to abstain. But some countries just decided that Israel's a reality. Why vote against it? There doesn't seem to be any cost at that point to voting against it. So who changed their vote? Greece, Turkey, and Cuba had all voted no on partition, but did not vote no on membership. Why not? So maybe Asher, can you tell me why Greece changed its vote? I really don't know. Any ideas? Yeah, no. So Turkey also, I'm not really sure, but Cuba, we know why.
Hi, can you hear me?
Now I can hear you, yeah.
All right. Well, it's possible that in gratitude for the United States saving Greece in the Civil War, I mean, we gave enormous aid in the Marshall Plan and in the Truman, particularly the Truman Doctrine, that kept Greece from coming under Soviet domination.
Okay. So that does potentially explain it. Now, four countries that voted yes on partition voted to abstain on membership. Denmark, Brazil, and Belgium. Now, Sweden, Denmark, and Belgium are European countries, Christian European countries. So why did they change their vote from a yes to an abstain? So I'll give you an answer. And this is an answer that might not sit well with a Jewish audience, but I'll say it straight. In 1947, the European countries tended to vote for partition as an apology for the Holocaust and other factors, including not wanting to alienate the United States. But in 1949, some Western European countries did vote to abstain. Nobody voted against, but they abstained because they were dissatisfied with Israel's behavior. They really didn't think that Israel was honest about its intentions in terms of the Jerusalem internationalization, Arab refugees, borders. You know, Israel, we the Jews are partisans in all this and are rooting for Israel. But if you're not a partisan and you're just looking at it from a perspective of international law, and you respect the UN resolutions as being having the weight of international law, you can't fault a country for in May of 1949 being suspicious of an expansive Israel that is non-compliant. All right, so I said it, even though the Zionists don't want to hear it. Okay, now let's go to the issue of the internationalization of Jerusalem, because this was one of the big three issues that membership was tied up in. So 1948, in December, Resolution 194 was passed. And it said, among many things, the following paragraph. Resolves that, in view of its association with the three world religions, the Jerusalem area, including its the present municipality of Jerusalem, plus the surrounding villages and towns, the easternmost of which shall be Abu Dis, the most southern Bethlehem, the most western Ein Karim, including Moza, and the most northern Shuafat, shall be accorded special and separate treatment from the rest of Palestine and shall be placed under effective United Nations control. So this is what was called the corpus separatum in the partition plan, and in late 48 was being reiterated. So was there a difference between the map of 47 and the map of 48 or the intentions of 48? Well, Israel claimed that there was a difference, that whereas in 47... the partition plan called for no sovereignty by Israel or by the Jewish state or by the newly formed Arab state in the corpus separatum, but rather it really would be an international zone. That in 48, it didn't say that. Rather, it said you're just going to have United Nations control, sort of de facto administration over a municipality, but that de jure, maybe the various countries, Israel and Jordan, will get to claim whatever they are able to claim. So that was an assertion made by the Israeli Foreign Ministry and by Shertok himself. But many countries in the UN General Assembly rejected that notion and said, baloney, we never changed our tune. Jerusalem is supposed to be internationalized in these borders without you having any sovereignty whatsoever. Okay. So what ended up happening? Well, it went to the United Nations Conciliation Commission for Palestine, the UNCCP, which met at Lausanne in Switzerland from April until September, from April 27th until September 12th. And they were supposed to try to smooth over those issues that were not resolved in the armistice agreements. But the UN Conciliation Commission was an abysmal failure. It really was just pushing papers that accomplished nothing. And yet, they retained the viewpoint that there'll be internationalization of the Holy City. One of the most important people to push for this was the Pope. Pope Pius XII called for the internationalization of Jerusalem, and it comes as no surprise, because after all, there are three Abrahamic religions. What are they? Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And guess which two have a stake, a political stake in Jerusalem? The Jews and the Muslims. Who has nothing? The Christians. So therefore, the chief Christian of the world, from his pontifical seat in Rome, issues an encyclical saying, oh, well, really, we should all share it together. Well, because he doesn't have it and he wants it. So this is the Pope interfering where his help wasn't wanted, as far as I'm concerned. And Pius XII had a poor enough track record on Jewish issues that his opinion is put in the garbage. Okay, so The United Nations continues in late 1949 to push the issue of an internationalizing the city. Israel, led by Ben-Gurion, vigorously and strongly pushes back. Was there anything for Israel to gain from the internationalization of Jerusalem? Yes or no? Yes or no?
Well, it would guarantee the access to the holy sites. To the...
Correct. So in truth, if this were a real good faith negotiation that could have resulted in some kind of a deal, then presumably that deal would have allowed Israel access to the holy places, to the Kotel HaMa'arvi, to the synagogues of the Jewish Quarter, to Mount of Olives, Har HaZeitim Cemetery, maybe even to access to Mount Scopus Hebrew University campus. All the things that Israel wanted in the armistice talks with Jordan that they didn't get potentially could have been had in an internationalization regime. So could have tried to negotiate this. However, none of that was nearly as important to Ben-Gurion and the government as was sovereignty and real control over at least a portion of the city, including the built-up Jewish new portion of the city. That was far, far more important in the eyes of the Zionist leadership than access to holy places. So what does Israel announce? That we're not going to pursue this internationalization agenda, and we will retain the new city of Jerusalem in the current borders of a divided city in the state of Israel. So basically annexing Jerusalem, Western Jerusalem, to the sovereign state of Israel. When does this happen? So there's no real decision by the Knesset or even the cabinet along these lines, but rather it's sort of a fiat decision by Ben-Gurion with his fist raised saying, this is what we're going to do. So on December 5th, 1949, Ben-Gurion makes a public announcement for the media that Jerusalem will not be forcibly disconnected from Israel. We will not allow international actors to separate Jewish Jerusalem from the state of Israel. If there ever was an informal kind of annexation, that was it. But he wasn't done, because since the UN was still pursuing this agenda, you have to do something else, and that is move the government. Moshe says, didn't they move the Knesset to Jerusalem? Yes, bingo. On December 13th, an announcement is made by Ben-Gurion that the government and the Knesset will relocate to Jerusalem. He claims that up until now, Tel Aviv was serving as a temporary capital city or a temporary home to government institutions, just because logistically and pragmatically there wasn't a way to function in Jerusalem while it was under siege and it didn't have access to supplies. So Western Jerusalem was a border town, a dusty border town in Israel's earlier years, and so it just wasn't realistic at first to move the government. But now, a year and a half after Israel's establishment, what's going to happen? We're going to move the Knesset from its seat in Tel Aviv to Beit Frumen on King George Street, not far from Ben Yehuda, in Yerushalayim, and there it would remain from 1950 up until 1966, when it would move to the current location of the Knesset, paid for by the Rothschild family. So for 16 and a half years, that building on King George Street would function as the Knesset. And what about government institutions? So government institutions also would move. The prime minister's office would move first, and then other ministries would move to various spots in Jerusalem. Two ministries did not move right away. And what are they? Who knows? Anybody know which ministries did not move right away to Jerusalem?
Defense,
and what else?
Did we say the foreign ministry?
No. Foreign ministry, correct. So defense and foreign ministry did not move right away. And there are reasons why. In the case of defense, it's very simple.
Because the foreign governments would not recognize Israel.
Well, that's the foreign one. But in the case of the defense ministry, it is because it was dangerous to move
that too. Yeah.
The Kiryah to a border town like Jerusalem, where you're a kilometer or less away from Jordanian snipers. At least in Tel Aviv, you're surrounded by a heavily Jewish area on all sides, in the Mediterranean and the other. So Tel Aviv is the most defensible Jewish city. Therefore, keep the Misrad HaBitachon in Tel Aviv, not in Yerushalayim. What about the foreign ministry? So the answer is, foreign governments would not recognize Israel's control over Jerusalem. At least some foreign governments, others would. It was a mixed bag. So in order to avoid complication, at least for a few years, they delayed the move of the foreign ministry headquarters. But by 1953, even the foreign ministry was in Jerusalem. It's just that many countries had their consulates and embassies elsewhere in Tel Aviv or Herzliya. Okay, now we have some questions in the chat. Let me just go to the questions in the chat. So Phil says, Turkey and Greece fought each other and figured Israel would be a good friend in the region, and each wanted Israel on its side. So the fact of the matter is Israel wanted Turkey on its side and Greece because of what Ben-Gurion believed was the periphery doctrine, that if Israel's immediate neighbors are implacable foes like Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, even the Jordanians, if the immediate neighbors are our worst enemies, then let's make friends with countries that are one layer removed. So meaning Greece, Turkey, Iran, Ethiopia, some countries in sub-Saharan Africa. So you want to have friends that are, you know, less than 1,000 miles away, but are, you know, not right on your border. Then another question in the chat was, the Vatican is eclipsed in power by the presence of the Greek Orthodox Church. We can see more credible with progress. Okay, right. So it's true. The Greek Orthodox Church was very hostile to Israel all throughout. Israel's had a very checkered relationship with the Latin Patriarchate, and it continues now. They are staunch supporters of Palestinian nationalism. Israel is serving the need of the Catholics to be a buffer. Okay, well, that's one. Alan Penn. Would it have been too politically chutzpahdik to annex West Jerusalem and call for international zone in East Jerusalem? Well, the answer to that is, of course, yes. If Israel was going to call for an internationalization of the city, it had to be the whole city, not just the side that they don't control. Although, after the Six-Day War, there was a little bit of talk about having an international presence in what had been Jordanian Jerusalem, but nothing ever came of it, and Israel ended up annexing the whole city.
I have a question.
Yes.
Okay, how plausible was it? How much really did these other countries believe that we were going to take the plitim, the refugees, back? Did any one of them ever repatriate, after a war, anybody who wanted, with the population that were, that ran away? It didn't make sense.
Okay, so the answer to that is that there was a real expectation on the part of many countries in the UN that Israel would allow back at least a token number of Palestinian refugees, or even more than a token number, maybe even 100,000, a significant number, not just a token number. Why was it thought that this was possible or plausible? Well, because Israel needs international recognition. It's a small, beleaguered country of, you know, less than 1 million Jews. And so if they can be pushed into a corner to do something that they don't really want to do, but they think they have to do to gain the favor of the world powers, maybe they will. I'm actually surprised that Israel was able to push back on the refugee issue and take essentially none. In part, they were able to do it because they could say, well, we're taking in Jewish refugees from the Islamic countries, and so it's a fair swap. You know, Arabs out and Jews in, and they switch sides. But this was not seen as a pie-in-the-sky idea. The UN Security Council really did believe they could force Israel's hand on the refugee issue, just that they failed. And so the refugee issue festered indefinitely. Okay. At this point, we're going to stop. So this is the end of a years-long study of Zionism. I hope you enjoyed it. Stay tuned next week. We're going to begin our new series on American Jewish history, cover hopefully 350 years of the Jewish experience in the United States of America. So stay tuned for next week. Take care, everybody. We'll have a minute in a few minutes.
Shabbat Tov. Easy fast.
Thank you. Easy fast, everybody.